Paddy Power and the Football Show, the greatest football partnership since Diofen Heskey.
Okay, Football Show, it's 3-0 to Manchester City, 48 minutes on the clock. Joe Malloy and Nathan Murphy with you. We will be talking Leeds United very shortly. Never has a team gone to Arsenal last and come away with so much credit.
Is it because it was on terrestrial TV?
Yes.
You think so?
And people aren't watching Leeds all that often, I suppose. And there was just something so sublime about the first 30 minutes in particular.
Yeah, even the full 90 minutes, just the quality of the passing from the goalkeeper was just ridiculous. But the bravery. Now, Arsenal were a shambles. It couldn't have worked out better in the first half an hour. It was proper Unai Emery jogging around the place for a team that suddenly had a bit about them.
Yeah.
A good game plan. Putting some pressure on them anytime they got in the ball and not being put under any pressure by Arsenal, it couldn't have worked out any better. But it did feel as though, because it's live on the BBC, suddenly just 7 million people watching a football match for the only time all year. Then I was like, wow, these guys in the Championship.
So we'll touch on that with Adam Pope, who works for BBC, covers Leeds, has been covering Leeds for a long time, and obviously on top of Bielsa, it does seem like we will see them surely back in the Premier League next season. They're not going to capitulate again, are they?
Well, if they do capitulate again, surely then he'll have to change his ways.
Yeah.
It does seem to be the one thing that he's an incredibly self-analytical man, but the one thing he's never been able to correct is that his team struggle towards the end of the season because it's so intense. They've lost a couple of players, obviously, going back from loan spells, which could be a bit of an issue. But I would also think if you're a Premier League manager and you have a 20, 21-year-old that Leeds were after and is not getting any game time at your own club, you'd say, take him. Take him straight away. Even the opportunity for a young player to go and work under Bielsa and to come back with that knowledge would be brilliant.
Well, I mean, it's amazing. He is the godfather, isn't he, that you have Bielsa and then Arteta, who's studied under Guardiola, who studied under Bielsa. It was all a muddle last night, but Arteta was saying they are a nightmare. They're a nightmare for every team to play against. I said before the game, to play against them, it's like going to the dentist. It's tough. They make it really hard. So we'll come to Adam Pope in a moment, and then we'll have James Richardson talking to us, because even though the Premier League is officially over, Serie A still has plenty of intrigue. Inter and Juve locked on 45 points apiece. Juve going for their ninth title in a row.
And generally it's been in that sort of double-figure style of cruising towards it. Obviously Antonio Conte, that was just a minor blip at Chelsea for that last season. Yeah. Like what Romelu Lukaku has done and the way he's got Lukaku back. Generally strikers tend to struggle at first in Italy. This is like you're watching Manchester United tonight and thinking, the right manager at the right time.
Yeah.
Surely he could have done the job.
He scored 9 goals in 10 away games, Lukaku, and Inter are flying. They beat Napoli away for the first time in 22 years at the weekend, albeit Napoli are struggling badly. They've only won 3 times at home all season. But still, Inter are flying. Conte got paid 26 million quid from Chelsea, by the way. That emerged today as well.
Him and his entire backroom team, so you assume he got, what, 20 million of that? Yeah. But which, in a way, surprising, because I always thought that the way these deals worked were we pay you up until you get another job. And he got a job in a reasonable length of time. Now, unless it's Chelsea, so you go in and you go, I'm going to get the deal of my life.
I would think so.
Right now.
We'll also check in on how Ronaldo's going. He scored his first hat-trick in the league for Juventus. He's 13 league goals this season, Ronaldo. I was looking, generally the top scorer in Serie A is somewhere around mid-20s. 25, 26 gives you a great chance. The one exception, and I think this is one of the great overlooked achievements, was Higuain in 2016, who hit 36 goals.
For Napoli.
Breaking a record which had stood since 1950. So other than that year, generally if you get to 26, 27, 28, you've got a great chance of topping the tables. But 13 goals this season for Ronaldo, it's not like he's rewriting the way Serie A is done there.
No, and hasn't really since he went there. And also his Champions League goals this year were way, way down. He finished with 2 in the group stage. And like he was often in the last few years could be a somewhat peripheral figure in games and come alive in the box. But they don't create a huge amount of chances. Like the one big disappointment at Juventus is that Ronaldo's arrival has seen quite a dip in Dybala's form. He's been better this year, but like Dybala scored a huge amount of goals 2 seasons ago, and you suddenly thought, well, Ronaldo coming, Dybala just behind him. This is going to be unbelievable. But whether it is the influence of Ronaldo on pitch, off pitch, like Dybala had been linked with a move away from the club during the summer. He's got it back a little bit. They're not as strong at the back. They obviously have some injuries. De Ligt starting to settle. Mm. Midfield isn't unbelievable. So maybe that Real Madrid team was actually an exceptional team with Ronaldo at the peak of their powers, peak of his powers.
We will, before 10 o'clock, go through the Brandon Mila story. He released a lengthy statement today. Despite his two-year ban, he released a lengthy statement denying he'd ever taken any banned substances. So we'll come to that. And we should, Nathan, for people just tuning in, mention what's going on at Old Trafford. It's not pretty, Manchester United fans. They are 3-0 down to Man City. Bernardo Silva, Riyad Mahrez, and then a Pereira on goal, all in the first half. City created about three or four other gilt-edged chances in that first half. And by the looks of the early stages of the second half, we're about 8-9 minutes into it now, they haven't really let up, Man City.
No, United can't get out of their own half for the first 10 minutes of this second half. Ah, it's been just so bloody easy for City is the problem. Like, you have Aguero and Jesus sitting on the bench, licking their lips, thinking, let me on, let me at them. Because like, if this goes 4-0 with 20 minutes to go, like, what's an acceptable defeat? Like, where, what's a defeat where tomorrow we're having a conversation whether Ole Gunnar Solskjaer could lose his job for the weekend? Like, if you lose 6-0 at home.
I think 6 might get it done.
You think 6 gets it done?
These are grim terms to be talking in.
5 is a debate.
5 is a, let's check in with Pochettino.
6 is, he's gone.
I think 6 might be, this thing's broken.
Let's give him the trip to Anfield and see can he get one last hurrah.
It looked a couple of weeks ago like things were improving. I mean, they had the big win at City. They were hitting teams in the break, admittedly. Mm. But they were doing well against the bigger teams. And you thought, well, there's something here. They have preached undying loyalty to Solskjaer. Like, they really have, above and beyond the ownership at Manchester United. But I suppose if you lose 5-6-0 to Manchester City at home, then it gets a bit trickier.
What does Pochettino do when he comes in? So the other thing is, if you get Pochettino in now, maybe you can make a signing, somebody that he's worked with, Christian Eriksen, and get him in, and maybe he can make a difference between now and the end of the season. Like, Pochettino is obviously an exceptional manager, but he did come to Tottenham just as the time that Harry Kane became one of the world's greatest strikers.
Took a while to put him in the team, actually, as well.
Dele Alli has this exceptional couple of years. Now, you can't take away how much of that was down to Pochettino. Does he have that type of player there? Like, maybe Marcus Rashford actually is just waiting for Pochettino to come in and bring him to a whole other level. But like, well, that group right now are not much better than sixth on the table.
They're still a better group than what Pochettino had at Southampton. And he managed to organise them into something very, very good. So you would presume straight away off the ball, their pressing would improve, their general organisation would improve. Like the goal they conceded, the second goal with the Lindelof header and then being out of position and the back four a mess. And even how Manchester United start play, it's just so laboured so often. I mean, the passing is laboured, players are taking the ball in standing positions. They never look likely to break down any lowly side. I mean, the bigger teams they can only beat on the break. So all of that stuff you would think would improve pretty dramatically if Pochettino came in.
So Solskjaer obviously, I don't know what his relationship with Ed Woodward is like, but after a defeat like this, United fans would love him to come out and go, well, this is a club, you know, you look at the last three transfer windows, we haven't bought any players. We bought three players last summer and that was it. We didn't buy anyone the January before. We did very little the summer before that. You know, you want to compete with Manchester City, look what they've done.
Yeah.
But he's not going to say that.
Well, no, he can't. Well, it's 58 minutes on the clock. We'll keep an eye on that game. All goals that go in, we'll keep you up to date on. But we do want to go to Leeds and hear about, this wonderful performance last night. Everybody raving, even though they lost, but there was a lot to admire. Here is Mikel Arteta describing what it was like to play against Leeds.
A nightmare. It's a nightmare for every team to play. I said before the game, to play against them is like going to the dentist, you know? It's tough. They make it really hard. They are a great team, you know, what they have achieved. To do it consistently every 3 days with those players, what they build there, it's powerful. You know, you can see, and every time you analyze any of the games, exactly like this, you know? So it's tough to see that. Top. I wasn't happy at all. The first 30, 35 minutes, how we started the game, how we approached the game. I tried to convince them before the game what to expect of that team, that they battered every team in the championship every 3 days. The way they play makes it really difficult and uncomfortable. Everything is man-to-man around the pitch. So it becomes a transition game. It's everything duels, everything is 50-50. So if you're not ready for that game, you get exposed and you get done. And obviously the second half was a different story.
There we are. That was Mikel Arteta. We have Adam Pope from BBC with us. Evening, Adam.
Evening, chaps.
So I guess, I don't know, I didn't actually check the figures in the BBC, but presumably they get 6, 7, 8, 9 million for a primetime game like that, Arsenal against Leeds. And the uninitiated got to see what you see most weeks, which is Bielsa's Leeds doing their thing.
Yeah, and that's exactly right. It was 6 million up last night. And great that it was on terrestrial television, because people now know who Gianni Alioski is, say. They might have seen clips of him here or there, but Patrick Bamford, they can see what he brings to the Bielsa style of play, etc. He might have his critics for not scoring goals, but you saw it in all its glory last night. And you were right. We see that every week. And I have to say, that first 45 was probably the purest one that we've seen it. There was an hour against Cardiff where they were 3 up before they threw it away to 3-3, which was probably as good. But considering the opposition last night, that was an exceptional performance from the Championship side. And I think it epitomised everything about Bielsa's sort of teams.
We on the show here have talked about Bielsa at length. He tends to crop up if you're talking about Guardiola or Diego Simeone or even Arteta to a point, or any other numerous managers who seem to have been influenced by this guy. So we're pretty familiar with Bielsa, and we've talked to you about him as well. When you say that first half, for people who didn't see it last night, was a perfect summation of what Bielsa has brought to Leeds. So what were they doing in that first 45, Adam?
Yeah, if people haven't seen it, the way Leeds play, and bear in mind there's two debutants there, they play out from the back, as we saw. Arsenal didn't press them, they were able to do that. But they work the ball laterally, don't they, across their own penalty area, and then they find, if you like, a vertical way through, and they find angles left, right and centre before creating numerous chances. Quite typically for Leeds at the moment, they miss a lot of them as well. They don't put them away. And that's what we saw. Everybody knows their place. And the best example of that, Robbie Gotz, 20 years of age, comes in, makes his debut. Ilan Meslier makes his debut in goal. Distribution superb. Part of the same unit, the same style of play. Replicated game on game, week after week, regardless of who the opposition is. And we saw that yesterday. People say that if you know how Bielsa plays and structures his team, he's going to be found out. Well, I don't agree with that, because if you keep creating chances like Leeds do, then you're not being found out, are you? If you can't stop people creating chances, then that this system is working. Plan A is always going to be plan A with them. There's never going to be plan B. It's just about doing plan A better. And it's so simple and so beautiful to watch. And I'm just so glad that everybody got to see it yesterday that might not have seen it before, because it really is just very pure football. It was beautiful to watch. And the great thing is, you're watching somebody that's doing it with the same players, pretty much, that he had when he arrived at the club, bar one or two. So it's all about good coaching. And that's why you're quite right to talk about Pochettino and Guardiola and people like that being sort of disciples of Bielsa, because he is, if you like, one of the ultimate coaches. He makes people better.
It is extraordinary, really, the extent to which you can do that, as you said, with largely the same number of players. And I presume even Leeds fans before the game last night would have wondered how this would translate away to Arsenal in the FA Cup. And, you know, that first 45 minutes in particular must have been a moment where you realise, oh, this can translate pretty well against anybody.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of the fans were using it as, is this a test now of the Premier League? Mm. And can Leeds cope with Premier League life next season? Obviously, the need to add. Bielsa, by the way, doesn't look it like that. He said, no, we can't use this as a test. We were beaten by Manchester United 4-0 pre-season. But when the draw was made, you've got to remember that Arsenal were struggling. Emery was still in charge. Leeds really fancied it. They were on a 7-match winning run at the time, and not dissimilar to last season. Within the last week or so, obviously, with Mikel Arteta getting a result against Manchester United, then you're thinking, well, hang on, this is a big game for Arsenal, this. So I felt that the odds of Leeds causing the upset had reduced. I wouldn't say dramatically, but somewhat. Mm. I always thought they were going to put up a great performance. I didn't realise Arsenal were going to be as bad as they were. I mean, they were awful. They went up for a tour in the first 45 minutes. But you've got to credit Leeds for that as well, because they totally went at them. Arteta knew what was coming. The rest of the side, as was witnessed by Lacazette's comment post-match, they didn't listen to him. It took them, 32 minutes, really, probably 45, to suss out what was going on.
I couldn't believe half an hour into the game, when I was just looking at the Leeds United goalkeeper and reading up on him, that it was his Leeds debut and he was only at the club since August. And like, maybe that's the perfect example of Bielsa's power and his style, because it looked as though he was the type of goalkeeper that Leeds would have based their game around all day. His passing ability was exceptional. And Like, is that the case that no matter who steps in, that they're so well drilled in the training ground that it comes quite easy to the players when he does have to go with some of the younger guys?
I think now that, I mean, obviously Mazdeh's an exception because he's coming in the summer, but I think when you look at the players that have been there within now a season and a half, then yeah, they are so well drilled. And he's actually taken a bit of a backward step, a bit more hands off, because it's about correcting mistakes rather than implementing a system. So they all do know it. Yeah, Mazdeh, if you listen to Bielsa's comments after the game last night, massive credit given to Marcus Abad, the goalkeeping coach, as well as to Kassir for supporting him, and the whole team that works around the goalkeepers, as a Polish guy called Kamil Majzak as well. So he has fitted into that system really, really well. But like all good clubs, and you see it at Man City, you know, Leeds under 23s play the same way. So Mesley, when he's played there, he knows what to expect. And you go down through, you know, the youth ranks, which are really, really good as well. Mark Jackson and Terry Potter and all these coaches that are there at Four Parks at the training centre. You know, they've got them all playing the right way. So, yeah, I think he does fit in easily. But I think very importantly, and some people might forget this, you know, he puts a lot of faith in Victor Orta, who's the sporting director, if you like. And, you know, he's the guy who goes and sources the players for him. So he'll say, look, I want this type of player. And he does trust him, it seems to be implicitly, to bring in the right sort of people into the club. Obviously, they're hoping for a couple more to come in January. But in this position, I think in the goalkeeping position, I think should, and you've got to remember that Kiko Kassir has an FA charge hanging over at the moment relating to alleged racial comments made in a game against Charlton in September. We'll wait to see the outcome of that. If he gets banned, which would be a minimum of six games, then obviously Mazdeh is going to have to come in and step right in. Having seen him yesterday, you wouldn't have any doubt about him being able to fill those large gloves and boots, to be fair.
We're talking here with Adam Pope. Adam, I think your mic has just been dislodged there in the last minute, if you want to grab it again and try and stick it up. Yeah. Give us a hello there, Adam.
Hi, is that better?
Yeah, I think that's a bit better. Yeah, there you go. Thanks a million. Sorry, we just lost you there. If you can hold that mic up as close as possible. It's all, the other amazing thing about Bielsa is that really, he seemed to endure what should have been potentially like a career ending, not career ending, but maybe tenure ending or certainly damaging scandal with the Spygate stuff. Was that about a year ago now? And just unruffled by the whole thing to the point where he makes this amazing presentation to everybody and it's live on Sky Sports News. And if anything, he's come out, I think we all like him a whole lot more ever since it turned out he spied on other teams and was so honest about it. So day to day, what's he like to deal with now that you've really got to know him over the years?
Yeah, well, he doesn't do any one-on-one interviews. That hasn't changed. You know, he is a man who does the press conferences pre and post-match through an interpreter. So we don't know him personally at all.
Yeah.
However, I think he's a real man of integrity, to be quite honest. And I felt my own personal view of examining what went on with Spygate, I think that was called into question, and I think it was wrong because he hadn't. You look at it, there was no rule broken. You know, basically, he's been fined and punished for something in retrospect that they've now wanted to, you know, close a sort of loophole on. So I found that quite a bit unpalatable, really. And almost to the point it was xenophobic towards him, some of the comments that were made. There was a worry that he might leave. He hasn't. He stayed. There was just as much a worry he might leave in the summer when promotion wasn't achieved. But he stayed through. Humble guy, quite a witty, funny guy. Literally a lot gets lost in translation. Loves the game. And knows he can make a massive difference to a very big area and a huge footballing sort of hotbed, if you like. And I think that's what drives him on. They adore him here. He's not beyond criticism, but they do adore him and the way that he tries to play football. So at the moment, the guy sort of can't do any wrong, but they're looking at the club just to help him out through January if they can, bring in a striker and probably a winger. Obviously, with Nketiah and Jack Clarke having gone back to their respective Premier League clubs.
They're obviously in a brilliantly commanding position in the Championship, but the one question mark over Bielsa, and as self-critical as he can be, the one thing he's struggled throughout his career to mend is that his sides, as the season rolls on, tend to struggle and run out of gas a little bit. It happened last season, meant that they ended up missing out on promotion. It's hard to see them having such a collapse that they wouldn't get promoted this time round, but is that a genuine concern, or do you think he's changed things, he's altered his methods somewhat to ensure that won't happen?
Well, firstly, he would vehemently deny the accusation that his team's run out of steam. I remember very late on last season, he was saying, my teams are still running faster, longer, harder, quicker than everybody else. And honestly, I don't think that's an issue. I think more of an issue is not having enough squad members I think that's more of a problem. And like you pointed out, they're already too late than they were a few weeks ago. Injuries obviously have been an issue, but he says he works on a quota of losing four people every week. So he seems to be okay with that. But honestly, running out of steam isn't an issue for these guys. They are supremely fit and it is very demanding. But I don't think they'll run out of steam. I think it was more they lost their nerve. I think a few of them felt they were already up. And when it got to the Easter weekend, when there was the collapse against Wigan, and then obviously the real nail in the coffin was the defeat to Brentford on the Monday, then that was more of an issue. I think they're more robust this season. He's playing the same way. Defensively, they've been stronger until more recent times when they've suddenly conceded 10 goals in four games. That's the difference to me. Ben White from Bryant has been a massive, massive influence. Hasn't been at his best in recent times. He came back to it yesterday against Arsenal. I thought that he has been a superb replacement for Pontus Janssen. And as absolute, alongside Liam Cooper, those two have really marshalled that defence in front of a very good keeper in Kassir. He's lost his way a bit in the last couple of games, but that defensive unit, far, far stronger than last year.
Adam, it's amazing as Marcus Rashford scores for Manchester United to make it 3-1. So that's a bit of a reprieve and certainly puts a nicer gleam on that scoreline from Ole Gunnar Solskjaer's point of view. That's in 69 minutes. Rashford, Man City lose possession. United pounced and hit them on the counter-attack as they're well able to do. So it's 3-1 after 70 minutes. It's amazing how the years go by and how suddenly Champions League odysseys are coming up on 20 years away very soon. We're all getting very old. And we know about the financial disaster, frankly, which followed all that. What's been the legacy of that? Leeds now, are Leeds completely free of all of that? Are they still carrying debt from that? I presume things like stadium improvements have been put on the long finger. Where is the club now as a result of that fall?
Well, you've got to know, now the club is owned by Andrea Radrizzani, or mostly anyway. So he actually owns the football ground now as well. Elland Road is now back in, well, it's still in private hands, but in his hands, and he's a much more benign owner than the people that he was with before, when the fire sale, sort of after the crash of the Champions League and not making more Champions League seasons, had really hit home. And so in that sense, they've got rid of a lot of the trouble. There is still a bit of debt around. The club still loses money, despite being, you know, a huge sort of revenue earner. So, and Radrizzani has said quite clearly, look, we've got a lot of plans here. I can't keep funding it, you know, to the level that probably it needs on my own. So they brought in the San Francisco 49ers, took a 10% stake about a year or so ago. He's very openly talked about wanting other people to come in as well. But there's a great chance of the Premier League now. He's in a strong position. I know he's sort of talking to potential investors. He's made that quite clear himself. So eventually, I think you will see a change of ownership, but he'll want to have his day in the sun in the Premier League. I'm quite sure of that, because the club is going to be worth, you know, loads more than it is at the moment. But I would say they're in the best financial position that they've been in since, and I've been covering them since 2005. Mm. I think they've been in the best position, or the cleanest position as well, when you think of some of the owners that have got their hands on the club and really taking it backwards by a long way. So at the moment, I think they're poised, really, to hit the Premier League in a very decent way. I'm not saying they're going to have like hundreds of millions to go and spend on players or anything like that, but it's the best condition I've seen it financially for a long, long time.
Mm. And so I guess keeping Bielsa is fairly essential. I mean, he'll get huge press and huge plaudits if he takes them up, especially if they win the championship. And he's obviously such a famous name right across football. Any whispers down the last year or so that he's been tempted away, or people have tried to lure him away? I mean, is Bielsa somebody who gets sick and tired after 2-3 years in the same place? Do we know his intentions?
Well, he hasn't talked to him. He'll just say, look, all that will be decided at the end of the season, like he did last season. I think he's got a deep love and fondness for it. I don't think there's any way that he'd be spirited away by another club at any point during the season. I just don't. I think he's very honest, very loyal. So, and he's really into it. He's really into it. I saw him walking through Leeds with his wife the other day, just minding his own business. You know, he lives very humbly, you know, a few miles away from the city itself, but has bought into it all. He really does like it. The way that he leaves clubs, or has left clubs, is if the promises aren't delivered. Mm. And so far, he's been very, very supportive and very, very complimentary about the regime, if you like, above him. So I don't see there being any issue with that being certain until the end of the season. If they don't go up, I think we might be in a similar sort of fearful situation as we were last summer, that maybe he thinks, well, I've done my best, can I do any more? But I don't think you can underestimate that he has a very, very deep affection for what's going on there. And he's had so much input into changes at the training ground, potential changes that they're hoping to move the training ground, and all loads of detail. Lots been spent so that things are right for him, so he can dot the I's and cross the T's. And you've got to say it's working. You know, the win percentage is excellent. The football's excellent. You know, the blooding of young talent is excellent. I know that's not all down to him. So for a modern day football club, Leeds are really moving in the right direction. And there's plans for expansion at the stadium, etc., moving forward too. So at the moment, you know, they're celebrating their 100th year. What a year it would be to, what a season it would be to go up. And obviously he'd be fated forever. I mean, who's before him? Don Reed and Howard Wilkinson. I mean, take him into the top flight. You know, he's one of a select band. And at the moment, 9 points clear. You'd think it'd be all right, but hey, nobody's sitting on the laurels on this. People are still nervous at this stage about whether Leeds are going to get this over the line.
Has there been any sense, I know you were talking there about the money and the potential investment that may come during the summer, has there been any sense from Bielsa as to what his sort of expectation would be in terms of buying players, or whether, by and large, he'd be happy with his coaching ability and this group of players, having worked with them for 18 months, 2 years, that continuing with that group would be enough to keep them in the Premier League if they get there?
I think you'd be quite loyal to a lot of these players. Calvin Phillips certainly has developed into a Premier League quality player. Other head coaches before him and knew he had talent, but the way he's developed, you know, he was linked with a big, big money move to Aston Villa, which they've staved off, you know, in the last sort of transfer window, if you like. So, and there are a few others, you know, Jack Harrison, who's been at Manchester City as well, he's come on leaps and bounds this year. Stuart Dallas, who'd had a fairly average sort of period at Leeds, having come from Brentford, you know, he's sort of 9 out of 10 every week for Leeds now. I mean, one of the most versatile players. Probably could do a bit of a job in the Premier League for them as well. So I think he would stick with a lot of them. I do, I think, not just out of blind loyalty, but honestly, because he believes he's coached them to a level. He's been asked that a lot of times as well about certain players. But it's not something he likes to indulge in and say, yeah, you know, I'll have, you know, 5 or 6 or 7 of these in the Premier League. Because they don't talk about the P word at the moment at all. But clearly they've got a plan at some point if this great season continues, because it will become an inevitability if they continue in the same vein. Personally, I think even now, I think there's still a few light. And up front, you know, Patrick Bamford, yes, he's got 10 goals this season, but on his own, that's not going to be enough at the moment. They are going to need more firepower. They are going to stay in the Premier League too. But I think they've got the nucleus of a side that could actually compete pretty well and obviously deliver a nice style of football. And who's not to say that they couldn't be something like what Sheffield United are doing this season?
Yeah, I think we saw the first hint of that last night. Listen, Adam Pope at the BBC. Thanks so much, Adam.
Pleasure. Really enjoyed it, guys.
Cheers, Adam.
Adam Pope there, who I'd say is enjoying life working and covering Leeds at the moment. It's a much easier gig than it was back in 2005.
Well, there's always something happening.
That's true.
In Leeds, whether it's positive is obviously not always the case. Maybe last night might be the worst thing to have happened, Bielsa, because suddenly there's going to be this big expectation if they get promoted that they can do a Sheffield United, or Wolves might be more a comparison that people would expect of.
The way we're talking, it's like they won 6-0.
Yeah, they did lose. The second Arsenal actually got it together. Yeah. They were beaten.
Yeah, so it comes with a health warning. So 3-1 as the camera picks out Ole Gunnar Solskjaer, 77 minutes in the clock. United have been much better, as we were speaking with Adam Pope there, on the ball more and more of the game in City's half. So as to our very grim conversation there from Ole Gunnar Solskjaer's point of view earlier on as to what scoreline might spell serious trouble for him, 3-1 will be just fine.
I think some of it, though, as well, has been City have taken their foot off the gas. Yeah. Where it looked as though they settled, like the goal, Rodri, was a disgrace for the goal. The ball comes to him in the middle of the pitch, puts a sort of half-hearted kick through the ball, dispossessed, the laziest jog back I've ever seen. It was brilliant finish by Marcus Rashford, like just the sudden intensity and pace.
Yeah.
Skips past the defender, lovely finish into the corner. So it is a very, very different scoreline. If they get a second back,
much better then. It's the type of goal Manchester United can score on the break, use their pace. But as for their general play, they're still struggling to break teams down. That looks like De Bruyne, who's gone down.
Yeah, there. A bit of a head injury. I think there was a bit of panic at first. He wasn't moving. He was face down in the floor. But Fernandinho ran over with a look of panic on his face. But De Bruyne just at least lifted his head. So it doesn't look too serious. Pep Guardiola's having a good go at Rodri now, I think, maybe explaining what he expects from him.
When you lose the ball, try running. 77 minutes in the clock, 3-1. Take a short break. We're going to be joined by the great James Richardson to talk to us about the Serie A title race next.
Paddy Power and the Football Show. The greatest football partnership since Geoff and Heskey.
Now then, you're welcome back. It's Joe Malloy and Nathan Murphy here. It's 3-1 to Manchester City, 80 minutes on the clock at Old Trafford. We are turning to Serie A. 45 points apiece, Inter and Juve at the top of the table. Juve going for a ninth title in a row. To what extent do we have a real, genuine title race? James Richardson is on the line. Evening, James.
Hi, how are you doing?
Hello, James Richardson.
Hi, yes, no, I'm here.
James, I don't think you're there.
Silence.
Oh, I'm here.
Oh.
Ah.
There we are. Here we go. Exciting. So we're good to go. Hello.
Hello there. How are you?
We're very well. We're very well. We're wondering just how excited we can get over this title race in Serie A.
Well, if you don't get excited about this one, you might have a long wait until the next one, judging by recent seasons. This is fantastic. Halfway through the campaign with Juve and Inter back from the dead, level on points, and really, I see nothing to choose between them. I think it's about as good a title race as you could hope for.
What has Conte done with this Inter side? Obviously, Lukaku is looming large in all the dispatches and reports and his scoring exploits we're hearing lots about. What about Inter generally? What has Conte done with them?
Well, just in case he's listening, I won't say that he's turned them into an offensive counter-attacking team, because somebody used the word counter-attacking to him on Monday night, Fabio Capello, who was doing a pundit job in the studio, and Conte just went off on him for about 10 minutes. He's very, very, very defensive about being defensive. It is true that his team, for example, away at Napoli, where they got their first win since 1997, ceded control of the game to the home side, Napoli, and just hit them on the break, as they do brilliantly with Lukaku and Lautaro. But the first thing that he's done is that with the arrivals of Godin, but also one or two young players coming through, they're really solid at the back. They've bought one or two, I could call them unglamorous, certainly from the perspective of anyone outside of Italy, young midfielders in Sensi and Barella, who are great ball players. And they haven't had them for the last couple of matches, which is why they've perhaps been slightly less interested in controlling the game. But, I mean, the biggest thing of all, and this is, I don't know if this is a stroke of luck or Conte says that this is something he always wanted to do, was to bring in Lukaku and pair him up with Lautaro Martinez. And the two of them, apparently best friends off field, get on brilliantly on the field. They've already scored 30 goals between them so far. And they're just a brilliant partnership up front. Lukaku's in outstanding form, and Man United have their own issues, but his departure for Inter has got to be one of the many things that their supporters must kind of question about the club's transfer policy. So I think what Conte's done is nothing that different to things that he's done at other clubs where he's been, Juve, Chelsea, etc. Defensively very, very strong, but he's been blessed by the fact that he's got a devastating counter-attack weapon. And equally on Monday, when they had, as they say, the first win away in Naples for decades, they were also aided by the fact that Napoli have completely fallen apart this season.
Yeah. Napoli just 3 home wins all season. On the Capello-Conte thing, as a brief tangent, seeing as you mentioned it, it does sound like one of the great things about Italian football. I'm sure it's a long-running tradition, and you would have experienced it in your time there, but that the coaches will often hear the analysis post-match or be interviewed by different people, and the exchange, you know, it seemed to be lengthy enough one. Mr. Capello, what are we talking about, said Conte. Fortunately, our opponents fear us more than those who watch us on television. I think I'm hearing nonsense, is what he said to Fabio Capello. Capello then is telling Antonio Conte he's not blind, and on they go back and forth. This is fantastic stuff.
No, it sounds a lot more entertaining when you say it. Basically, with Conte, he was the grumpy guy who just would not let it lie. Capello was being quite reasonable, and I mean, they're not Juventus. Juve are a passing team into the way at least they were playing on Monday. And as I say, they have had absences in midfield, are a more pragmatic side. And you know, they are a very good team playing on the break. That's not to say they can't do other things. And interestingly, there were a couple of pieces today in the Italian press saying, you know, why is Conte so... why did he take such offense at the term counter-attacking? Because that's part of the Italian tradition. But so Capello basically observed the fact that Napoli had more possession and that Inter were deadly on the break. And Conte just kept going back to it. He said, here I am, I'm smiling at these remarks. And they tried to move him on, but he's one of those people. It's funny, you think he'd have a lot of things to be cheery about, given the league form and the astonishing amount of money we now find that Chelsea lavished on him and his various technical assistants after their departure from Stamford Bridge. But I guess that's how Conte is.
What's Conte done with Romelu Lukaku? Is it that system, let's call it counter-attacking system, that works to his strengths? Is it more a mental thing that he's managed to rebuild him after what happened at Manchester United? What do you see has changed for Lukaku that he's in such brilliant form?
Well, it's interesting because Inter's not necessarily an immediate fit for Romelu Lukaku, and certainly in terms of the ambient, the environment, that's not always been the easiest of arrivals for him. There were problems with racist abuse. Inter itself has been a completely, by their own definition, they are a crazy club, and they're not a particularly easy club to go in and be an enormous success at. We've seen a lot of players try it there and not succeed. I think the fact that it is simple, what they're trying to do, I think the fact that he's got this partnership with Lautaro Martinez shouldn't be underestimated, because Martinez is somebody who, as far as I can see, everybody he plays with seems to do well. He seems to be an extremely technically gifted, but also generous player. And that partnership, which when it works, when a player can find another player and they can fuse their abilities, they can fuse their skills, they can become greater than the sum of their parts. It's really a blessing for any team. It's not something you can always program, but when it happens, it can make your season. It can make a title. And I think that's what's happening here. Lukaku's always been a player who has had brilliant seasons before. He looked like an absolute phenomenon when he first came through. And I think that's what we're seeing again now. He's very much the focus of that club now. He's got a player alongside him who is the perfect feint for him. And feint, in fact, would be the word, F-E-I-N-T. Well, on the first of the goals he scored away at Napoli, he breaks and basically uses Lautaro's run to clear out the two Napoli defenders who managed to stay in the right place, and then just absolutely destroys Merritt with this thunderbolt, which Merritt gets a couple of hands to, but it just bounces off and under him and then into the net. It was going at well over 100 kilometres an hour. So, a combination of things. He's enjoying life in Milan, as indeed you might.
It's a long time since Inter have won Serie A, all the way back to Mourinho's time in 2010, and look, we're only halfway through, but when you look at the squad and the depth and maybe the investment that's there, if clubs were to come in January and look at some of those players, like there's a lot of speculation around Milan Skriniar, the Slovakian defender, been linked with both Manchester clubs, are Inter in a position financially where if teams come in with big money bids halfway through a season that they can hold them off?
I believe they are. I think the financial might of Suning behind them means that at least midway through the season, they're not about to throw away the greatest chance they've had of winning a title for a decade. The talk at the moment is very much about players they'd like to bring in. Eriksen's been mentioned a lot in the English press, and I think that's something that is perhaps more likely to happen in the summer. But they're quite positive, or at least there are a lot of noises in Italy about them getting hold of Arturo Vidal from Barcelona. So at the moment, it seems to be a campaign of strengthening rather than of departures.
Meanwhile, Ronaldo scored his first hat-trick in Serie A for Juventus. He's on 13 league goals this season. What kind of pace are they going to set? How are things going under Sarri? What's the general mood music around Juve?
Well, the mood's better now. They had, I think, what's generally accepted to be their best game of the season against Cagliari, who are not a huge club, but have been one of the revelations of this campaign. They didn't have a full-strength defence, and I think that was one of the issues for the Sardinian side. But even with that, they managed to hold out for the first half, and then it was Ronaldo who pounced on a wayward pass at the back and took it around the keeper and put it away, then scored a penalty. The third one was a bit more of a tap-in that was set up for him by Douglas Costa. One of the nice things, actually, was seeing how readily Cristiano Ronaldo celebrates with his teammates at Juve. Not something that we always saw, perhaps, in Madrid. But he seems pretty happy. He was rocking a pretty interesting look when he turned up at the stadium. I'm not sure if this has been widely reported, but he was using not only an iPod Shuffle, which a lot of listeners will have to ask their parents about, but also headphones with actual wires, which it was a kind of an interesting retro take. A lot of people have been trying to decode what that exactly means, but for now, he's he's remained stuck. But yeah, he's doing brilliantly. Mm. He's got one goal fewer than Lukaku, and slightly sluggish start to the championship this time around. But he's now hit form. Sarri, excitingly, is now using Dybala and Higuain and Ronaldo up front together. We'll see if he'll do that every time, but it's something that the fans have really been waiting to see. And just before Christmas, he finally started, and it seems to be one of his options now going forward. Juve, Sarri, they've got so much talent right throughout the side. De Ligt, their massive summer signing, even starting at the moment. They're going to be, you know, you'd be crazy to rule them out, but then again, you'd be crazy to rule out Inter. So I think we've got a fantastic title right ahead of us.
Just one last quick one, James. The man who scored the first goal in Serie A in the last decade is the same man who scored the first goal in Serie A of the 20s. That is Mario Balotelli. Obviously in a very different place in his career and life and now than he was back in 2010. He's with Brescia. Do you know of Balotelli? I mean, like, his days have been a major force in world football or behind him for sure. But has he calmed down as a personality? Has he found any kind of equilibrium in his life? Or where is he as a person these days?
Well, it's interesting. He's back home, basically. I mean, Brescia is where he's from.
Yeah.
And, I mean, I don't mean that kind of glibly. I think the fact that he has returned there, I think, is after so many adventures, I think is testament to the fact that he's just reined it back in a bit. He's scored 5 goals so far this season. He's had one or two issues with, obviously, some of the really despicable elements of the tifoseria in Italy, the racist abuse that he suffered, and the fact that his own club didn't seem to back him up either. Massimo Cellino, who obviously everyone's going to know over here for Leeds, is now the guy who owns Brescia and was making jokes about the colour of Balotelli's skin rather than giving him support. Then they changed manager, then they changed the manager again, brought the first guy back in. So it's been a really disrupted season, but throughout all of that, I guess the big story about Balotelli is it's not him who's causing all the confusion, you know. He's been there, he's scored goals, the club have done all the craziness, the fans have done the craziness. But, you know, he's doing his job. I think, yeah, the question now, as you say, the days of being a massive influence on the world scene are behind it. But what would be interesting to see is if he could put together a really strong second half to the season and find his way back into the national side, because it's an interesting Italian side that's warming up for the Euros. And I think there is a place for a strong centre-forward. Belotti's going to be in there, you'd think, probably. I mean, Immobile definitely as well, who's having an incredible season. But yeah, a centre-forward of the talent, of the natural talent of Balotelli's kind, would be a wonderful weapon for Italy, even after all these years. Now, whether he'd ever make it back in, there's a lot of feeling that Mancini just doesn't fancy him, that, you know, there's thoughts that he doesn't fit in well with the rest of the squad or wouldn't do. But that would be really interesting to see. For now, though, as I say, the story is the fact that there's craziness at Brescia, but none of it's from him.
Okay. James, listen, pleasure as ever to have you on. Thanks so much.
No problem.
Cheers. James Richardson there with the latest on all goings-on in Serie A. It's finished 3-1 at Old Trafford. Back in one sec.
Paddy Power and the Football Show, the greatest football partnership since Diouf and Heskey.
Now then, welcome back. So it's finished 3-1 at Old Trafford. Stirling Park for Manchester City in the second half. They said, we don't need to ruin this Ole Gunnar Solskjaer thing here. 3-1 will do us just
fine. It's in our, it's for the benefit of us the longer this lasts. one of those probably shows the gulf in class that Pep Guardiola looked the more disappointed manager at full time with the way his side took their foot off the gas in the second half, because United finished it well. They were actually last 20 minutes without creating a huge amount of chances aside from the goal. Mm. Were probably the better side, whereas for the first hour it was just so easy. Yeah. There was quality there, obviously, for Manchester City when you look at Bernardo Silva's goal, the strike from 25 yards. Mm. But the other two goals were just a mess.
Not good. So it's finished 3-1, second leg at the Etihad. It's Leicester against Aston Villa tomorrow. Just we mentioned it at the top of the show, it is an important story. Brandon Mila has insisted he's never taken any banned substances. He was found to have violated anti-doping rules, handed a 2-year ban from all football-related activities by Sport Ireland. He was the PFA Ireland Young Player of the Year in 2015 when he was playing for Shamrock Rovers. Had been doing very well, 26 years old now. He had been facing the prospect of a 4-year ban But then in a hearing at the start of last month, he was able to plead his case for leniency. And he revealed details, basically, and he released a statement to this effect as well today, that while he was spending the 2 hours trying to give his sample after being a substitute in a match, his daughter had hit her head and they were very concerned about her at home, and his wife was getting on to him and saying, I need you here, and he couldn't pass the sample. In the end, he passed a sample of sorts, but not enough in quantity, and he made the decision to go and find his daughter and go and be with his family, but obviously that meant he had left the drugs test.
Yeah, and I think when you read his statement, it certainly makes a compelling case, because, well, once you mention a sick child, I think people automatically are going to have sympathy. Mm. Sport Ireland obviously release a full report on their side of what happened. And I think it sure shows up some holes in that statement and what he was saying in terms of how they look at it. They felt, and they say in this, that they felt Mila misled them into believing that his child was in hospital, that the tester offered to accompany him to the hospital. They didn't go to the hospital, he went straight home afterwards, that the child wasn't actually brought to hospital, as they were led to believe. And I think that was the breakdown in terms of there was obviously something else happening with his child, which was obviously a major concern to him, but that they, and unfortunately this is the life for professional athletes, that the tester will go with you wherever you got to go, didn't take up that offer, and also that Brandon Mila was well aware, I think, that when he was leaving without giving the full sample, that there were going to be repercussions for this.
Yeah, and there certainly have been. So a 2-year ban is very substantial. He's 26 years of age. His full statement, you can read it on offtheball.com. He goes into detail about how he felt he had no option but to go and be with his daughter and his wife. His daughter had been sick previously and he felt he needed to be by his family's side. And that was the position he found him in. But as you've said, Sport Ireland have a slightly different version of events. So the net result is a 2-year ban for Brandon Mila. We're about done for this evening. We're back tomorrow. Jack McCaffrey, hopefully in studio tomorrow. We'll have Wednesday night rugby as well. And don't forget, OTB AM, 7:30, as ever, on all our social channels, or the Go Loud app is where you can get OTB Sports Radio. Ty Kennelly is going to be in the show tomorrow with Jaron Owen. We played you a clip that earlier on. It's a very good interview, well worth catching tomorrow morning. Nathan, my thanks to you.
Cheers.
And we have Tom Dunn on the way next.
Paddy Power and the Football Show, the greatest football partnership since Diofen Heskey.